Sam Fantastic. Hornsby, hello. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolute pleasure.
Co-founder, CEO, Triptych. So I want to, what do I see when I look at you? That's kind of how I like to start these podcasts. Okay, so I see, and this is, you can correct me and tell me I'm completely wrong if I've got this. I see someone that entered the strategic consultancy world from a different part. So I look at your LinkedIn profile and I see that your first year was working in Mumbai as a business analyst. Yeah. And then you move throughout what I would presume would be more of a management consultancy route into strategic consultancy. You then went to a place called Flamingo, which I want to hear all about. Mm. And now you founded your own strategic consultancy. You're probably shuddering because I'm calling it the wrong thing or going, no, it's not a, it's a, but.
It's close enough.
Okay, fine. We'll go there. Before I get into kind of why Triptych and how that happened and all the brilliant things that you've done, I want to know more about who you were when you first started. Mm. So, Sam Hornsby.
Yeah, great.
Who was the first person to make you feel like you had talent?
First person to make me feel like I had talent. Genuinely, and this is probably no surprise, but you know, I'm very fortunate. My parents, and I would say, particularly growing up, the thing that comes to mind is when I was pretty young, my mother. Said to me, and I don't know if this was grounded in much truth, but she noticed that I loved to sing. And she actually said, you've got a great singing voice. And thanks to her, I went to music school when I was pretty young. And she took me, drove me to, you know, different auditions, and I was learning the piano and other instruments at the time. And ultimately ended up being a chorister in Edinburgh at St. Mary's for several years. And that was, I think, the earliest kind of formative memory I have of somebody saying, hey, you're pretty good at this thing. Why don't we explore it? Why don't we see where it goes? So, you know, I attribute all and more of my modest success really to the great upbringing that I had and the amazing parents that I had. But there have been many, and I think the other one that probably comes to mind is a little bit later on when I was at school. I think a lot of people have teachers in their lives who just have an incredible impact, and I have so much admiration for teachers, the way that they can shape and form and inspire people's growth. But I had a history teacher at my high school when I was growing up in Scotland. He was an incredible guy. And Mr. Houston, if you're listening, thank you. I loved history. And I remember him saying to me at the end of one class, you know, Sam, I think you should apply for Oxford. And that was the first time anybody had ever suggested, you know, that I could... should apply for Oxbridge. And he was amazing. He helped me do interview prep. I remember going to his house after school, and he was just an incredible person. And I think that's something, it's like a trait of these amazing figures in your lives, is that they help you see beyond, they help you see your potential. And they don't just point to it, but they really, you know, coach you towards it and really help sort of guide you to realizing that talent.
Yeah. I always find people that end up doing what you do have got this annoying blessing of right and left brain. Mm. As in, I imagine there would have been a point in your upbringing, career, the way you've gone, okay, which one do I want to pick? Mm. Which route do I go? That's
exactly right.
Because I can see you, analyst, mm-hmm. I imagine you looked down the lens of that and went, ugh. Where does the fun begin? Mm. And then equally, I don't know where you would have been. I'd love to know, was there, I always get the left and the right confused. On the opposite side of analyst, what were you looking down the lens of? Mm.
It's a really interesting one. And I think it's true. There was a fork in the road for me actually pretty early on, which was, you know, when I was leaving high school, and this is obviously quite a long time ago now. But the paths were art school,
yep,
or Oxford. And I had a great heart for both. You know, I loved art, and there's a part of me that still identifies as a creative in that way. Mm. Some of my happiest memories I remember growing up were literally just being, you know, alone in a studio, painting and creating. But I was also so interested in a deep understanding of the why,
yeah,
and kind of and really sort of sharpening my knowledge of how the world works, how systems work, how cultures work, mm. How meaning is created, and that kind of more, as you say, analytical side. And so that was the path that I kind of pursued through in my early education at Oxford. I studied anthropology and archaeology, which was an amazing kind of foundational basis in, you know, 5 million years of human history, and really helped me kind of apply my curiosity to understanding, okay, you know, where did all of this come from? How did we get here?
Yeah.
You know, this sort of beautiful, bewildering world that we live in, you know, how did it kind of come to be?
Yeah.
And so I think in many ways, you know, my kind of career as I entered the professional sphere has been about balancing those sort of two pieces, really. It's the creation and the creativity, but it's also the research, the understanding, the curiosity, the exploration of culture, the deep decoding of the kind of the why.
Yeah.
And both of those sort of lefty brain and righty brain, I think, aspects kind of come together actually in pretty well in sort of what Triptych is today.
So, okay, before we go into Triptych and how that came around, because I can imagine a business analyst, you would never have even dreamed that that sort of business exists, or I imagine access to that business wouldn't have been that clear. What was the route?
Mm. It's really interesting, and I have the privilege of you know, speaking to a lot of people who are finding their way into the industry, who are kind of trying to navigate this very quite sort of perhaps willfully obscure kind of world that we call consulting, design, brand services. As you know, and as I think you know, you really try to kind of push through, there's a lot of jargon.
Yeah.
And I think it can be really challenging for people to kind of understand and navigate what actually is the work, and is it right for me? You know, I was very lucky early on in that I joined a group it was Omnicom, and the first handful of years there were really about working across multiple different agencies. So I did stints in CRM agencies and digital agencies, PR agencies, experiential agencies, research agencies. And that was amazing because it really helped me figure out what I love, what I am less drawn to. And I think kind of accelerated my career, because I know that it can take other people 5-10 years to actually try enough of this sort of industry to be able to zero in and kind of hone in on what they love. And you know, for me, I was just really drawn to the insights. I was really drawn to the upstream part of developing and building brands and growing businesses through brand. And maybe it was part of the anthropology training that I had, but I was really, really interested in not so much the very tactical executional elements, although obviously the art and science of that is really important, but really kind of, you know, what is the human truth?
Mm.
Or what is the emerging kind of cultural phenomenon that is important to the brand or the business? How do we understand that? How do we understand what our brand actually fundamentally, foundationally means? And then build from there. Because, you know, what I was seeing was, unless you've got those foundations really strong, unless you know who you are as a brand, unless you know who you're for, unless you know what future you're building for, there's so much waste in the system.
Yeah.
Because you end up throwing, you know, bad dollars after bad, spending media, developing creative against something that fundamentally isn't right to your purpose, to your DNA, and to where the world is going. So that was kind of my early journey kind of around this this ecosystem that took me to Flamingo, the agency you mentioned there, and then onward, you know, to set up Triptych. But yeah, my very first, I had a bunch of first gigs. You mentioned that analyst job in Mumbai. I mean, that was a pretty quick, I love to travel.
Yeah.
And I've lived in China and brief stints in India, obviously grew up in Europe, live here now in New York. But I love the thrill of rapidly learning about a new culture, a new company, a new country. So Mumbai was like a really interesting kind of eye-opening experience, but it was pretty brief. I had a bunch of other jobs before I actually kind of stepped in. I mean, I tended bar in London for a while. You know, I did a stint doing passage. but I tell you, actually, I think tending bar is a really, or just being in the service economy is a really good foundation for the kind of work that that we do in the service industry. And actually a lot of the time, you know, when I'm interviewing or kind of talking to people about why they might want to join Triptych, I am looking for that spirit of service. I think unless you are motivated to create an experience for other people and to make them look and feel good in their job or role or whatever it is, you're kind of in the wrong space, because that's fundamentally what the whole job is about. So whether you're, you know, bussing tables or serving drinks or, you know, whatever it is, I think like hospitality and kind of service is a really good analog actually to a lot of what we do, because the product is the product.
Yeah.
And it has to be world class. But what people remember and what your clients remember is the experience that you created for them.
So how did that happen? So I want to kind of go to maybe it's the Flamingo times when you were there. Can you remember a moment where you were like, this is exactly what I should be doing, or this is defining why I am doing this thing?
I think there were loads, actually. There were loads. I mean, I found that period, I want to say 8-10 years, to be with that firm, to be very closely aligned to drives me, what motivates me, what makes me tick. It was an extraordinary opportunity to apply that curiosity.
Yeah.
I mean, that agency was, you know, I think at the time, the best at cultural intelligence, at, you know, understanding consumers deeply, mixed methods research, trends, futures, semiotics, applying that insight to brand. And I got to travel all over the world. This was the days when, you know, when you had to, and my clients had budget for it too. You know, amazing years of flying around, meeting people from completely vastly different walks of life to myself, and doing interviews, really, a lot of interviews, just like this one, where you could really, in sort of privileged context of being able to ask them anything and really get to the why and really understand what motivates and drives them and what influences them. And it was incredibly nourishing to be able to go out and kind of expand my worldview like that. But the moment that within all of that, and there were many that kind of, to your question, felt like, wow, yes, this is exactly what I should be doing, was when I was in Shanghai. So I went to China for about a year, and the project we were working on was the foundational strategy for Disney's Shanghai Disney Resort. So this was Bob Iger's kind of big bet and legacy, and it was a huge investment but a incredibly thorny and interesting cultural strategy challenge. Mm. You had, on the one hand, Disney, the most quintessential kind of American company of all time, the company that is built on and really in many ways creates Western values, self-actualization, individual achievement, you know, et cetera, as represented in all of the narratives and all of their franchises and IP, doing a joint venture with the Chinese government to establish this, you know, this park. And got to remember that at that time, a lot of Disney properties and IP was banned in China. So you were launching a Disney park to a population who had been restricted from access to a lot of the stories and characters and narratives that we had been brought up with. So there was this incredibly interesting strategic challenge of how do you create a Disney park in a way that works and appeases both the DNA and vision of this Western dream-making company with the drives and motivations and needs of the CCP, which is all about collectivist values.
Yeah.
And also, how do you design a park experience for people who, frankly, don't know or aren't as deeply invested in any of the characters and kind of stories that make that place sort of special? So it was a really incredibly interesting challenge. I was extraordinarily grateful to have the opportunity to work on it. And there was a lot of really very interesting translation work, essentially, sort of had to be done. I remember taking executives from Burbank, you know, out into the field in China to kind of really get up close and personal and meet the, you know, the next generation of Chinese kind of consumers and understand, yeah, they've got different, totally different attitudes, totally different lifestyles, totally different behaviors, totally different beliefs. We're deep, you know, we're building for a different culture, but equally working in these environments where we're kind of trying to translate notions that we just take for granted, growing up in the West, like the idea of following your dream, for example, to you know, their Chinese business partners, for whom like that idea is just doesn't really exist in their culture, right? It's a totally different, it's a totally different idea. Yeah, the word in for dream in Mandarin actually doesn't really translate in the same way. You know, there's sort of proxies, but it comes closer to the idea of an ambition, or or it can sort of veer the other way in terms of like unrealistic fantasy. But this idea of kind of your dream,
and,
and that
who you should realize and become,
and who you should realize and become as an individual, is not really sort of represented in their vernacular, in their language. So that was a moment that for me just felt really truly fascinating and interesting, and kind of the sort of work that I love to do, that we love to do, which is, you know, big ambitious projects, multiple stakeholder groups with different orientations and agendas, but driving that process forward through really deep cultural understanding to get to great outcomes.
Okay, I'm gonna humanize, because that was well done, de-jargoned for sure.
Thanks.
I just wanna focus on Flamingo for a moment, because I think that's a nice vehicle into Triptych to understand what weren't they doing, or what did you see in terms of an opportunity in the market? Why would Disney or a brand like Disney come to Flamingo? What would their problem be? What would they be, a typical traditional issue that they would be having for them to go, hi, is that Flamingo? Can you help us out? Yeah. What would be happening internally at a brand like that?
Yeah. So I would say that, you know, there are typically triggers or kind of inflection moments within the client business that would kind of prompt an outreach to Flamingo, and then probably a different set of kind of triggers or prompts to get in touch with Triptych. But I think in Flamingo, a lot of the sort of moments were, look, we need to unify the organization around an understanding of who we're for, or an understanding of the market that we're serving. I think a lot of times, client organizations, corporates, even the most sophisticated ones, can really be drowning in data, but are often lacking real sort of true insight.
Yeah.
And the important sort of leap from insight to strategy. So, you know, so what does this mean? So I think in the instance there of the Disney work, it was very much, I think, a realization internally that we, Disney, know much less than we should about China, Chinese consumers, Chinese culture, and that is foundational if we're going to make a success of this project. And that's really where it starts. Mm-hmm. From there, those insights can take you into all sorts of places. What should the food and beverage offering at the park be that speaks to, you know, mealtime habits and snacking habits and different rituals for this consumer? What should the core amusement attractions of the parks be based on what Chinese consumers are actually drawn and interested to? You know, do they like Star Wars? Do they like Toy Story? Who knows? You know, how should the park deliver on things like holiday and kind of the, you know, the moments, because there's a different set of rituals and moments there than we would sort of celebrate in the US parks or even in sort of the European parks. So, I mean, they had a park in Hong Kong, still do, but so there was some analogs, there's some case studies, and there's definitely some learnings, and there was learnings to bring from all of their kind of parks into it, but there were definitely really important nuances in terms of where China was then, but also where China was going, because this investment in this joint venture really represented a, frankly, a really, it was kind of one of the proof points of sort of China's opening up. You know, the fact that they welcomed in that deal and would do a joint venture with Disney was at a moment when it was turning its face to the rest of the world very assertively and deliberately. And Shanghai, which has always sort of been the kind of the gateway to the West as a sort of city, whereas Beijing is much more the, you know, the political capital, was the sort of the logical place to do that. But it was also really important to sort of build this park with an understanding of what China was trying to do by engaging with Western narratives, Western businesses, Western ideals. There was a lot to kind of understand and represent.
There is a lot there, and you've answered that really well, because I can't, it sounds, the thing I try and get my head around, if I look at the landscape of creative services, and I understand you probably sit in creative services and also out as well, because it's consultative as well, which you could argue, I'm trying to make sure, because it's not as simplistic as you go to a creative ad agency, for example, you go to an Adam and Eve and you say, right, you know, we have a comms thing and it's da 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 da. Generally, the output is going to be press and outdoor, digital activation, you know, TV ad, something in the communication sphere, branding and design, again, similar story. Slowly, that's moving away. I think one thing I really want to speak about is how branding is entering into the strategic consultancy world as well. But if you're, and I think it's a tree, I almost feel like it begins at strategic consultancy and it goes to then branding design and then communications and production and PR. Where does this start and stop?
Yeah. Where does the journey start?
Yeah. Because that's what you just mentioned there with Disney. That's everything. The brief could potentially be, what the hell should we do with this? Mm-hmm. So like how, yeah, I'm curious as a sector, you know, as a strategic consultancy, as a sector, but also hopefully that could be a nice sort of segue into Triptych. But yeah, how does business come around? How does that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So I think the, you know, the distinction I would draw is that, as you say, there are a lot of parts of the sort of the broader creative service industry where the engagement might start with a fairly tight brief. And a lot of, you know, as you know, the work that happens, say, in an advertising agency or a PR agency or a media agency, is often these days, particularly for big clients, happens through procurement channels where there's a brief that's fed out to multiple agencies and they all come to the table and go through a process and, you know, pitch their solutions and potential deliverables. Our work is really different. We typically do not, you know, engage with clients through that sort of procurement channel. Because the work we're doing is really quite solution agnostic.
Yeah.
It's insight and strategy led, but it could lead you to a product solution. It could lead you to a communication solution. It could lead you to a design solution. So we tend to be upstream of that. And as a result, a lot of the time when we're at our best, we're actually co-creating the brief with the client. And we're actually kind of, you know, a lot of there's work to be done to actually really formulate what is the business challenge?
Yeah.
What is the brand need? What are the objectives? What's the learning agenda? Who are the stakeholders that are going to be taking this work forward? How are we going to sort of organize ourselves around this opportunity? And we do quite a lot of work, even before sort of the receipt of the brief, in deep collaboration with the client to make sure that the foundational kind of questions are right and the work stream is set up for success. So it's much more co-creative, okay. It's much more collaborative, and work as a result comes in a lot of the time more based on referrals, or based on recommendations, or based on existing trusted advisor relationships we have with senior clients. It's sort of a different form. And I would say that, like, you know, you sort of, I mean, we, as you know, Triptych is a joint venture with an incredible group, Havas. Havas has, I think, 700 agencies around the world. It's by no means the biggest, but it's a very resource-rich group and network, and I'd say more agile and so more innovative than some of the sort of traditional holding cos. It really is a kind of a company. But within that ecosystem, we have pure play management consultancies. Mm. So there's an incredible agency in our network called Gate One, which is more of a competitor to sort of the big, you know, it's a boutique competitor to the big four. It might go up against a McKinsey or a Bain or an Accenture. Up there, they're dealing with M&A, operating model. They're dealing with digital transformation, new tech stacks, new processes, all of, you know, that kind of core foundational business and digital transformation work. Our work is more in the realm of brand transformation. So sometimes it follows on from some of that kind of business transformation, but sometimes the starting point is, hey, we've just got a fundamental brand challenge. We don't know if our core meaning is right for growth. We don't know if we're targeting the right people. We don't know if our brand architecture and portfolio architecture is correct. We don't know if our design system, our creative system, to your point, design and branding, it's foundational and strategic because it informs that creative set of guidelines, informs everything that you then do across your product experience digitally, across your communications experience, and so on. So the word upstream is like overused, but I think Triptych is a consultancy driven and strategically driven proposition. And so in that way, exactly to your point, it's not so much about starting from like a finite set of deliverables. It's not about saying, hey, we're going to do a campaign here, or we're going to do an activation there. It's much more about what is the problem we're trying to solve.
Okay, I want to hear how it all began. So what did you see? Talk me through. I mean, like, my knowledge of that part of the world is lesser so than perhaps it would be branding design agencies and creative agencies, and I can tell you most of the companies within the Havas group, but probably not the consultancies. So what did you see? What you were looking out from Flamingo and you were thinking, right, I want to do my own thing. I'd love to know what the trigger was there, but perhaps we'll do that offline. What were the options? What did you see out there in the landscape and go, okay, this is what I think I want to create?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think fundamentally, the two things that I saw and continue to see, the problems, or depending on how you look at it, the opportunities that Triptych was built to solve for, are kind of they're twofold. One is, culture is changing very fast, and culture is complex. At the same time, culture is the most powerful determinant of people's attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs. It is what shapes people's relationship to your brand and to your business. And I believe, and we believe at Triptych, that in order for a brand to grow and be successful, it has to understand deeply culture and has to be able to show up and connect to and contribute to culture in order to be successful. And I think there can be a tendency within corporate organizations to have blind spots around cultural change. We often have great microscopes that go in with a lot of precision around understanding a consumer or a category, but we're not very good with the telescopes and really kind of looking out and around. And unless you have both, and unless you can have that kind of cultural intelligence, you can be disrupted and upended extraordinarily quickly. And there's many, many cases of brands and businesses that were flying high, but missed a cultural trend, or suffered from a cultural headwind, and it devastated their business. Whether that's a changing beauty norms, if you're a Victoria's Secret, I mean, there's the list goes on and on and on and on. So I think that cultural understanding is really where we excel, and we combine that with a kind of a mixed methods approach to understanding markets and opportunities, and really help clients sort of fill that gap and fill that blind spot. The second thing I would say is there can also be a tendency, quite naturally, with the way that corporates are structured and governed, to be quite, let's say, short-term sales growth orientated in the way that their brand is built and the way that their marketing apparatus is sort of deployed. What Triptych really helps to solve for is, yes, you need that engine. You absolutely need the art and science of delivering on brand message, delivering on performance, delivering the right product stories, working consumers all the way through the journey and the funnel. But you also need to be building your core brand foundations, which are serving you on a multi-year horizon. So the longer view of how do you create enduring brand value is really where we play. A lot of our work is really building tools and strategies and frameworks and systems and playbooks and roadmaps that are going to serve that brand organization on a multi-year horizon. And that's quite hard for a lot of corporates to do. And particularly when times are uncertain like they are now, it's quite hard to get investment in those things because everybody's focused on, okay, how do we, solve the challenges in the sort of the here and now? But we believe, and the data is there, and the case studies kind of galore, that really prove out, you need to be focused on long-term brand value creation in concert with that sort of near short-term sales growth orientation. So those are the two things that we really specialize in: helping clients see around corners, see the bigger picture, help understand culture, the tectonics, the headwinds, the tailwinds, but also how do they build enduring value for their brand? Ultimately that is, in many cases, 30% of a company's sort of market capitalization is basically built on its brand value, right? So corporates and leaders absolutely need to be focused on all the parts that contribute to that brand value.
This is what prompted me to reach out to you originally. I read the Fast Company article, you're you know, contributed
to. Thanks for doing your homework.
Hey, well, thank you. You're welcome. Well, this is, you wrote something in there which was around, it was cues. You wrote CQ and EQ. Mm. Everyone's heard of EQ. And what, the question I wrote there was, what happens if a brand doesn't embrace this? Because you also mentioned a thing called boardroom bias. And I can really understand and imagine what that is. Mm. You know, you've got a board that are all nodding and going, yeah, this is a great idea. Yeah. And then you put it out into the world and it's like, what the hell are you doing?
Right.
Was that what you were referring to? And what is EQ versus CQ?
Yeah. So this has been something I've been thinking about a lot actually recently, particularly I'd say with the advent of kind of AI, where quite rapidly and suddenly we're although AI has been around for a long time as we know, but with the advent of Gen AI in particular, rapid acceleration of our IQ capabilities, our kind of analytical capabilities, the ability to process and synthesize through logic, vast kind of quantities of data. My experience though is that transforming brands, transforming organizations, is fundamentally, it's about people. And with all of the tools in the world, you're still in the business of changing hearts and minds internally, across a huge array of different stakeholders, divisions, departments, constituents in this vision and purpose you have as a company, also changing hearts and minds of your customers, you know, out there in the world. That process is not just a logical process. It is not just an analytical process. It is not just about number crunching. It is not just about, the sort of analytical IQ capabilities we have. It is fundamentally about having partners and talent that can apply emotional intelligence to a problem as well as cultural intelligence to a problem. The emotional intelligence piece is really important. You're dealing with a whole array of attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs. You're trying to understand what drives and motivates people, what levers you can pull. You're trying to understand, and internally, you're also trying to understand what ideas are going to connect emotionally to consumers out there in the world. So in order to deliver those strategies, you have to have a high degree of emotional intelligence. Cultural intelligence piece is really important, again, internally and externally. Culturally, there are different cultures within big companies. Mm. You know, it's very rare to have a monocultural organization. Your data science department versus your marketing department versus your boardroom versus, they all have their own sort of orientations and kind of cultures. And we work a lot with global companies. So you're also working across very different national cultures and sort of orientations too. So, and again, that's all of the internal piece. The external piece is, right, okay, well, we're serving customers who are living in quite often vastly different cultural contexts too. So the process of creating brands, transforming brands, using brand to move businesses forward is really, you need that EQ and you need that CQ. And that's why I'm personally really quite optimistic and excited about, the sort of the future of our industry. I think AI can be a great enabler and co-pilot and accelerator. It can take a lot of the graft away and help people focus on the craft if used correctly. But that kind of higher order skill set of whether it's the people you hire as a company or the partners you engage, that skill set of do they have the EQ and do they have the CQ in order to be able to navigate this complexity and drive change amid that complexity, I think is going to be more important than ever. So that's really what I was kind of speaking to. The boardroom bias piece is just a component part of that, which is you can have a board or an executive group who maybe or may need help actually seeing through their own biases to understand, okay, what does this part of the business actually need and care about? Or how important is this other thing here? Or, Very few, I'd say, boards are composed of people who look like the consumers that they're built to serve, right? Yeah. So there's just deltas there,
yeah,
and gulfs that you have to help them bridge in order to be, you know, consumer centric, in order to be servant leaders to their full organization, in order to connect to broader culture. And I think that's a lot of the role that we are privileged and get to play.
How does that not end up becoming like, it makes so much sense. There is a vast diversity of cultures, and you could almost say it's infinite in a way, because, you know, for some of these brands, everyone's a consumer, right? Or like for some of these companies, they have every kind of demographic within their business. How do you pick which ones are the leading, you know, the leading cultures that define what that business is going to then say, this is what we are and what we aren't? Because surely the inverse of doing that, and if you end up going, look, we're for everybody and we need to make sure we tip the cap to them, but, you know, every version of someone in this, because I've had it myself with the 17 person company when we were 17 people. And I felt like we were becoming the more, what's the word I'm looking for? Aware of who we were serving and aware of who we were made up of. Mm. The more we tried to become right for everybody, the less the distinctiveness of our brand, you know, was there. So how do you do that when you've got such a vast variety of humans to appease?
Absolutely. Well, that's exactly the kind of thorny challenge that we love. And because I think fundamentally it comes back to values, and it comes back to DNA, and it comes back to ethos. It's not about, as a brand, fragmenting yourself to serve, although we can talk about kind of AI and mass personalization and what all of that means from a content and communications delivery standpoint. But fundamentally, I think it comes back to deeply understanding who you are as a company, what is the value that you bring to the world, how is that ethos and DNA and heritage and kind of core governing values codified so that people internally and externally can assess for themselves clearly whether you're right for them or not, whether that's attracting talent to hire for your 17 or 17,000 person company, or whether that's engaging, you know, customers and consumers. If you stand for something that is real, that is meaningful, that is authentic, and you deliver on that promise, then you will be magnetic to customers and to talent. But a lot of the time where companies, I think, and this is a journey I've been on as well in terms of building Triptych, is you can never invest too much in those foundations, right? Because they really are the bedrock. Upon which all of that is built. So, and I believe if they are strong and well developed, you know, you don't get that fragmentation. And look, there always has to be nuance. There has to be nuance in execution, and you have to also give, you know, your teams and your brand leaders and your marketing teams the ability to kind of flex and reinterpret and kind of reimagine those foundations for their roles and what they need to achieve. But it has to be anchored in that kind of, those deep truths, you know, about who you are and where you're going.
So funny, because when you try and, I'm thinking back to a time like 2 Januaries ago where I was like, okay, right, culture feeling like it needs a bit of a, you know, shape up. Like, I feel like we're getting further away from what we originally set out to become. We'll get into a room and we'll do the values thing. And it's like, one thing I am actually really proud of when we did this was, and you would have laughed about how we did it, we just sat in a room, we had these 5 values, and I actually had a really embarrassing moment. I went onto a podcast and somebody asked my 5 values and I forgot them. It was the classic, shit. I was like, courage, and, you know, stupidly, we'd pick 3 C's, courage, curiosity, and compassion. And then the other 2 are accountability and grit, which is, I love those 2. They feel very relevant. You know, you can't be a good recruitment company without accountability, and you certainly can't be a good recruiter without grit and working beyond what's expected. But compassion, curiosity, and courage. I'm already forgetting them. Fuck me. It felt that like there was an almost purposeful alliteration there. Like, you know, I'll just chuck those ones in because it makes sense. Mm. So we were quite brutal. Mm. And we just went, look, you know, this over that. Which one is more important?
Yeah, focus,
it is compassion. Be really honest. If you're rowing a boat with somebody and, you know, the person behind you, nothing awful happens and they've just stopped rowing for no reason. Mm-hmm. And you turn around to them, you've gone, why aren't you rowing, Dave or Daisy? And they say, well, I just don't want to. The level of compassion that you have for that person for not being accountable is very low.
Yeah.
So we sort of decided we're going to sack compassion off. Okay. And we're going to sack courage off, because actually...
That's really interesting, because I mean, that, you know, that that speaks to an ethos and an orientation, right? And that speaks to kind of a set of values that, you know, for your business and for your team, you know, makes sense. I mean, the metaphor that you use there is a really interesting one, right? Like the idea of we're all rowing in a boat together. Like when values are tested, what do we all need to demonstrate in order to succeed, right? But different companies use different kind of metaphors to surface and bring those things out. But something you said I wanted to pick up on, because I think it's really important, and it's a feature, you know, not just of the values creation and delivery process at Triptych, but a lot of the work that we do for our clients, is the words are the words, but the words have to be translated into a set of behaviors, and they have to be translated. And you know, this is where a lot of these exercises around kind of building these foundational components fall down, is they end up just being words on a page. Right, we've all walked into the, you know, the corporate office where the posters are on the wall and they say, you know, we insert thing here, you know, strive to achieve greatness for all of our blah blah, right? Yeah. And but people don't look at that and say, okay, I know what that means for me and my job. Mm-hmm. I don't know what set of behaviors are expected. I know what is living that value, what is not living that value, and it's not woven in to the operating system and the operating environment of the company. And actually, even if a word feels like generic, curiosity is one of our values as well, it's foundational, it's just a word unless you describe what that means through the workflow for every person and every job. You know, and for us, we've been doing, and it's work that I'm really passionate about, and it's never ending, is that codifying and operationalizing of values throughout your business, into job descriptions, into workflow processes, into company rituals, into the way that we communicate. All of it has to be kind of in service of and so sort of supporting those values. Otherwise they're just ideas. Like, they're just, you know, they're too lofty, and they're not actioned.
100%. The best thing we ever did actually in that session was we made everybody write, if you have an unknownian, which is what we call somebody that is, you know, super unknown and pure unknownian.
We tend to say tripticians.
Oh, tripticians. Yeah, get your specs and your values in one. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. we said, look, you know, imagine you've got this unknownian they're facing. You've got the perfect person that is just like the best example of them. Write down all of the behaviors and the things that they do on a daily basis that make them that version of them. Then flip them and, you know, do the same thing that makes them not. You know, what are the most unacceptable behaviors for that unknownian to exist? And we ended up just with this person with post-it notes all over them, you know, right front and back. And it was good, you know. Was it like that?
What's that board game? Do you remember the one with the doctor and you have the...
Guess Who?
Yeah, it was like... Guess Who was the flippy
one. Oh, okay.
Do you remember the one I'm thinking about, the board game where you played sort of a doctor and you had to diagnose...
Operation. Yes.
Great game.
I know. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. Great game. Kind of, yeah, but you're sort of sticking on rather
Post-it
than taking
note operation.
On. Yes.
Yeah.
Post-it note operation. Okay, so... Triptych in the future. So how big are we now? Where are we up to?
In terms of client-facing talent, we're about 45 around the world. So the majority of that headcount is in North America. We're headquartered here in New York.
Yeah.
Very excitingly, over the last 18 months, we've started to spread our wings globally. So we have a great team in serving the EMEA region out of London, and we have a small team, growing team in Singapore, servicing APAC. We also have, which is one of the favorite aspects of Triptych, we have an incredible design team in Mexico City.
I saw this.
And they are just so incredibly talented. It's such an amazing hotbed of creativity, yeah. That city. And so they've been really powerful in terms of building our kind of design capabilities, supporting our group globally. So we're about 45, and then we have, because it's a joint venture, we have a bit of a best of both, because we have fantastic partners in Havas who provide a very strong operating platform for the whole business.
Yeah.
So that means that we get to springboard from these fantastic village offices and cities all around the world. We benefit from all of the infrastructure. It means that we have world-class and really deep resources on areas like talent, on obviously finance, PR, operations, facilities, and things like that. So what's nice about that is it really allows the talent that comes to Triptych to be very focused on the work, mm. and very focused on the clients. You know, one of the things I've seen my time in the industry is that there are lots of brilliant things about being a boutique and being an independent boutique. One of the less brilliant things about that is that you often have senior leaders in the business or founders in the business who get into the business because they love the problems, they love serving the clients, they love motivating the teams, they love delivering the work. But you can end up spending a huge amount of your time doing the operational administration of the business. And what's great about Triptych is that we have, as I say, sort of a best of both for our team, because you have that tight-knit team of 45 that are all working on the client projects, and then this shared service platform that supports the rest. But for our clients, it's also a bit of the best of both, because you get that very high-touch consultancy, independent boutique, strategic kind of feel and delivery. There's not a lot of bureaucracy. We mobilize, high allocation, multidisciplinary teams around kind of problems. But if they want to tap into additional services, additional resources from across our global network, we can do that seamlessly. So you've got kind of, a strategic boutique, but with a built-in network, which is great.
It's cool. It's almost like, I use the term fast and deep quite a lot, which is like we can move really quickly because we've only got 45 people that we need to run this by.
Right.
But if you need us to go even further and deeper, we've got that in spades as well.
We can access it.
It's really good.
We can access it seamlessly, and I think increasingly that's what kind of clients are looking for. They want that best of both. They want speed. They want agility. They want leaders with craft involved in the work, as they well should.
Not just selling and running away, kind of
And but they also need a partner that can grow with them over time. Because like I say, a lot of our work is, solution agnostic. We don't necessarily know what the best, vehicle for delivering that strategy is when we set out to solve the problem. And so you might very quickly need to say, oh, okay, this means we need to activate these customers and stakeholders in experiential or PR over here, or actually this points to like a really important need that we need to clean up our corporate website and digital infrastructure actually, because we're telling the wrong story about our company, and you need your partners to be able to seamlessly say, that's great, okay, here's the PR agency that's going to do that for you, here's the CX group that's going to build out that that digital platform for you, and let's keep going and let's keep building, let's not have to stop, pivot, rebrief, etc. And you only want to take that as far as is natural.
Yeah.
And you only ever want to be in a position where you're recommending the very best solution to deliver on the strategy.
Yes.
But I think what's been really exciting for me over the past sort of 6-7 years of Triptych is, more and more clients are trusting us to bring additional groups, additional capabilities, additional services to the table, to serve their business, to grow that relationship even longer and deeper.
I was going to say that there's the temptation, I haven't got to look too far at Uncommon, another Havas acquisition, where they are the independent creative studio that would be doing much more executional stuff than a Triptych. I can imagine it's a blessing and a curse, or it works two ways. Do we want to double down and be more good at this one thing and refer business into the group? Or do we actually want to say, actually, that's not too far away from what we do. We can indeed produce the CX build or whatever it is that you're asking us to refer in. Mm. That must be a balance. That must be a balance of like,
it is.
When do we say yes and you know, have to lean into 5 degrees away from where we are? And when do we actually go, no, this is definitely not the right time for us to do that? Mm. Must be hard.
Well, it's hard. And, you know, I think like a lot of the complex corporates that we consult and advise for, mm. you know, Havas in and of itself is a very obviously complex organization of 23,000 people. Jeez. Around the world, 700 plus agencies, you know, and continues to evolve and innovate and change to meet the moment and meet the market. But I think for me, the and you know, bring up Uncommon, which I think was just such an exciting acquisition.
Yeah.
You know, back to what's important, back to the values, back to the ethos of the company. Creativity is the lifeblood of Havas, you know. It is a company that was born of the best creative, exists to produce the best creative, and Uncommon are arguably the best, you know, in that sphere, right? For what they do. And so it's a natural fit, and I think a very sort of logical acquisition. The what comes with that, of course, is what does this mean for this part of the group? Mm. What does this mean for that part of the group? How do we take clients on a kind of a consistent journey through these sort of offerings? But if we continue to attract, acquire, and grow the very best, and produce the very best creative work, I think a lot of those problems will kind of be solved in post.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
I think they're going to, they'll correct, because ultimately we're all one team, we're all one company. We just want to produce the best work. And Uncommon brings obviously amazing accolades, an amazing bench, an amazing ethos, and a way of delivering creativity that we can all learn from.
Yeah.
And I know I am, and a lot of the other creative leaders in the business are just super excited to have them as partners in our culture.
That's quite cool to have them across. I have two last questions. I realize we're like coming to, it's unbelievable how quickly this goes by.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's insane.
Always wild.
Yeah.
So two predictions. Number one is, I want to hear prediction of Triptych. So if all the good things go well in the next 12 months and everything goes to plan, what will be different about Triptych?
In the next 12 months?
Mm. I should have done what I normally do, which is, it's the 10th of April, okay. 2025. What is different?
The date could
be. Yeah, I know, it's scary.
Already in April. I mean, I would say that, I would actually come back to what we were talking about before, which is the values will be the same, but the living and expressing and delivery on those values and the weaving of those values into every aspect of how we work will be even stronger.
Okay.
We'll be 12 months on from where we are today. I think we are we're on that journey. You know, we're getting better and better all the time in terms of asking ourselves, okay, what does curiosity mean in terms of not just like how we show up for our clients, but how we ask questions? For the experience that we create along an engagement journey, what does it look like in terms of the output and the work? And there are just so many cool ways that can be woven in and sort of brought into the business. I think in 12 months' time, I'd like to think that we're going to be celebrating even better growth and even stronger culture because we've done that work to be values driven and be accountable to them as well. Like, I think one of the great things about, you know, being a values-driven organization is that, you know, it gives everybody a signpost and it gives everybody a yardstick to say, hey, this is right for me. You know, this is the place I want to be, or it's not.
Yeah.
And I think you know, great organizations are always kind of going through that, you know, forward-looking kind of process of saying, hey, look, you know, get on this with this company and deliver on the values and be part of its growth or not.
Yeah.
Right. And so change is good in that way, I think, you know, and I think getting kind of comfortable with the discomfort of that change is really important for an organization to go forward. You have to be constantly iterating and kind of reiterating what you're about.
Yeah, that's really good. And then the last thing for me is prediction for the industry, which is, I know it's brutal, and try and be as brutal as possible because normally people wiggle out of this one.
Yeah, okay. So
I want to just one thing that you believe that isn't going to be here, or perhaps is going to unequivocally change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 12 months. I'm not asking like 5 years because also you can easily dip out with an answer like, I don't know, no one's going to need whatever something in AI because that's obviously going to happen in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I want 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that, I think we're, this isn't a dodge. I think we're in a really interesting, moment of the cycle at the moment. I think we're in a moment of pretty prolonged uncertainty. Through last year and into this year as well. My prediction for the industry in 12 months actually is that I would like to think this time next year, post US elections, and I'm optimistic that the uncertainty and sort of stagnancy that we've been experiencing for a while will have cleared in some way, shape, or form. I'm not going to say it's an economic rebound. I'm not going to say, because those are things very, very sort of difficult to predict. But I do think there's kind of a limit to the point which people can sort of delay decisions and delay investments. And I think by this time next year, we'll be back at a place where people are okay saying, okay, right. We just need to get back on with it.
Yeah.
We need to get back on with the business of building our strong brands. We need to get back in the business of understanding our consumers. We need to get back into the business of transforming our culture and our organization and setting it up for growth. And all of those other things that we've been kind of wrestling with and navigating, how do we adopt AI? What do we do about, the balance of brand and performance spend? What do we do about, shaky discretionary spend? All of those things are still going to be in it, but we have to make some decisions and kind of move forward. So that's my hopeful, my optimistic prediction.
Yeah, that's
for reason to be cheerful for this time next year.
Okay, yeah. Not I think the hell now, we've got between now and
then. I think between now and then, it's going to continue to be pretty tricky, actually.
Okay. Well, okay, that's nice. It's like the end of the tunnel, I guess.
There's always light.
Yeah.
Big picture view.
Exactly.
And look, I think, I'm a big believer. You've probably read this book as well, but I'm rereading Atomic Habits by James Clear, right?
Yes.
And that is such a good book for kind of moments like this because it's a great reminder that goals are good and they set a direction, but they change. And if you don't deliver on them, that's one thing. But you learn from that. What's really important is that you keep systematically improving.
Yeah.
And, building the culture, building the team, building the ways of working, delivering on the values, striving for excellence in everything that you do. And if you keep doing that and make those marginal gains and marginal improvements, you're gonna achieve what you set out to and more. And I think that's kind of the sort of the mode that we're in at the moment a little bit now. I think the goals are uncertain, or delivery on the goals for a lot of businesses, particularly agencies right now.
Yeah.
It's a crazy time. But what matters is, okay, are we building the system that serves us for success? So
I love that.
Systems building this year.
You do not rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems.
There we go. Remembered it.
There we are.
Great quote.
Thank you. I'm going to put that and attribute that to your name. But Sam, thank you so much for this. This has genuinely been so lovely to get to know you.
In this great room, on these great couches. It was the time really
It flies by.
It flies by. It went fast. But thanks for the time. Thanks for the questions.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Appreciate it.